Welcome to Nightlife, a bite-size episode.
If you were looking out onto Newcastle Harbour in the early hours of the 12th of January 1906, you would have seen a ship in the harbour on fire and burning furiously. You're about to hear the story of the Itata, a ship which carried coal and nitrate. Now, if you know anything about coal and nitrate, you'll know they should never be packed together in the hold of a ship. And then the Itata met its end in quite spectacular fashion, probably because of this. Dr. James Hunter is a maritime archaeologist at the Australian National Maritime Museum. He's with us for our Monday night look at Australian history. Hello, James. Welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening.
James, what exactly is the problem when you put coal and nitrate together? Why are they a bad mix to have in the hold of a ship?
Well, nitrate tends to be a fairly unstable thing. It doesn't like water very much. And when you introduce it into an environment where there's water, you increase the risk of it igniting. And of course, if you have a source of ignition next to coal, which is a flammable sort of thing, it's a recipe for disaster.
Which is exactly what happened. So tell us about the Itata, which appears to have made its living out of transporting coal and nitrate. Where did it travel to during its life?
So the Itata was an iron-hulled bark. It was a three-masted sailing ship. It was built in Liverpool in 1883 by a company called R.J. Evans. And it was your typical run-of-the-mill sailing ship that transported all sorts of merchandise around the world at the time. But it largely was engaged in a triangular trade between the United Kingdom, South America, and Australia. And the primary cargo that it carried was nitrate and coal. The nitrates were being picked up in South America, particularly in Chile, where there was a large amount of that, loaded aboard the ship, and then it would go to Australia, where it would offload part of that cargo and pick up coal. Of course, Newcastle and areas of New South Wales being large deposits of coal, it'd pick up the coal and it would head back to the UK where it would drop that coal cargo off.
And so what was it doing? Obviously, it was in Newcastle. It was a regular stop-off point. But tell us about what happened in the early hours of January the 12th, 1906.
Yeah, so it had come from South America. It had dropped off part of its cargo of nitrate in Sydney and had loaded about 350 tons of coal there. In Newcastle, rather, after it made the trip up from Sydney to Newcastle, it loaded this cargo of coal. And
it still had plenty of nitrate in the hull.
Yeah, plenty of nitrate there. And it was sitting there at anchor, basically, and a fire was detected in the early morning hours. The source of the ignition or the cause of the fire is still debated and speculated about to this day. It could have been any one of a number of things, but certainly putting two cargoes that were flammable and combustible together was not a good idea. And so in any event, something caught fire. The nitrate cargo soon caught fire fairly quickly and began to burn and even explode. And of course, it had this cargo of coal as well, and it soon caught fire as well. Amazingly, some people in Newcastle had the wherewithal to tow Itata away from the main wharves, because that's where it was, and managed to get it out into the outer harbor, where, of course, there was a risk all of this detonating in rather spectacular fashion. So
it would have been known that nitrate was sitting there and that this was ready to really go boom at any point.
Exactly. I mean, once this process started, there was no way they were going to stop it. The only thing that was going to stop it was it exploding and sinking. And so they were pretty quick smart about getting the ship out into the outer harbor. And so that's what they did. They towed it out there, and then they sort of formed a circle around it to keep other vessels a safe distance away. And there it sat. It burned for about a week. The coal cargo burned. There were several detonations of the nitrate cargo exploding. And amazingly, it didn't sink. This is what I find remarkable, is that this ship simply did not sink.
Why wouldn't it have sunk if it had been there on fire for a week with explosions left, right, and center?
The only thing I can say is, A, it was incredibly well built, and B, luck. Just nothing but pure luck, because under those circumstances, and you have to see, there are photographs, Tata, on fire. some of which we have in our collection at the museum. And there are photos of it afterwards. And the ship literally melted. It is amazing to see. The beams that went across the ship that would have supported the decks, these were iron or steel, they melted. And you can see them, they're sagging, where they just kind of lost all their structural integrity as they heated up to an extreme heat. The sides of the hull buckled in. The masts, which were also iron, they melted at their bases and flopped over. And so you see this thing at anchor after the fire had been extinguished, and it's got these big masts just drooping over the side where they collapsed.
And yet it did not sink well. And James, I understand some of the explosions during the time the nitrite exploded were loud enough to be heard 20 kilometers away.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, really, really loud detonations. And again, it goes to this whole sort of wonderment that this thing didn't sink. And I find that amazing.
Must have been quite a sight in Newcastle Harbour, I'm guessing. Were people able to sort of stand on the shore and watch it on fire?
Oh, I would imagine people did that. As soon as word got out, you know, the banks would have been crowded with people. And I know in the photos that we have at the museum, there are boats all around it. And a lot of those boats, I'm sure, were there to sort of keep other vessels from wandering into the danger zone. But I'm also pretty sure that there were some spectators out there, too, who were just, you know, waiting for the big boom because people can't help it. You know, they love that. That's why they go to, you know, car races and that sort of thing. They're just hoping for the big boom.
Something mammoth to happen. James Hunter is with us, a maritime archaeologist at the Australian National Maritime Museum. So we've got this ship. It's bent. The masts have flopped down. It's melted, but it hasn't sunk. And someone goes, oh, I can use that.
That's right. It is probably not the best business move that's ever been done, but there was an individual in Sydney who paid, you know, a little bit of money for a Tata.
Do we know how much?
Oh, it wasn't much, but it would have been, you know, a couple hundred pounds, I think,
right,
which for that time, that was still a sizable chunk of money. And yeah, the whole deal was that the vessel would be towed down from Newcastle to Sydney Harbour, and it would act as a coal hulk, you know, a floating storage container for coal, essentially. And so, yep, the transaction was made, and poor little Itata was towed down to Sydney and got there, and they very quickly figured out that it was a really bad purchase because it started to sink almost immediately.
Oh, finally it started to sink.
Right,
when they loaded the coal onto it.
That's right. And who knows why, you know, maybe it being out at sea, you know, the sort of the ocean, you know, hitting it sort of worked any sort of openings further apart. Or the other thing that I've wondered is, you know, given that steel or iron tends to expand under extreme heat, I wonder that, you know, maybe the opposite was in play. Once it was underway, it cooled off. And so as it shrank and contracted, it opened up, you know, gaps in the hull.
So here's this fellow who said, I'm going to spend all this money. I'm going to have this really cool, super cheap coal carrier, but now it's sinking. So what does this person do?
Well, one choice would have been to try to repair the hull and make it serviceable, but that probably would have been really expensive.
Throwing good money after that.
Yeah, we've already thrown enough really good money at this bad business choice, so let's not throw any more money at it. And this individual ended up doing what most people did when they got tired of ships or a ship had reached the end of their life, and that was to park it somewhere out of the way and walk away from it. And that's what happened to Itata. It was taken around to Middle Harbor, to an area known as Sailor's Bay, Salt Pan Creek, and it was run ashore there, and it was abandoned.
And today divers dive on it.
Well, that's right. I've actually been on the site once. It was kind of a funny thing. We were wanting to go outside the heads that day, and it was a bit dicey, and we thought, oh, we need an alternative. And we knew about the Itata. You can see the bow sticking out of the water quite prominently. And so we said, hey, let's go around and have a look at the Itata. Why not? You know, it's sort of a joke because we thought, ah, you know, visibility is going to be atrocious. Probably won't be able to get into it. There's a lot of boats that are moored there. And surprisingly, we got in. We were able to moor up. We jumped in the water, and the visibility was 6 meters, and it was stunning. I couldn't believe it. You could see quite a bit of the hull. We actually swam all the way down the starboard side of the hull, down to the stern, and swam up through the middle of the hull on the way back. And it was fantastic. there was a lot there to see. And what really amazed me was how much sea life was on it. But again, we got lucky. We had good visibility and we just didn't stir the bottom up.
So how big is it?
It'd be around a couple hundred feet in length. And at the deepest end of the pool, again, it's probably around, you know, 6-8 meters of water. So it's not terribly deep, but it's a big thing. It really is. And it's largely intact. That's the amazing thing. All the, you know, the wooden components, the decking and stuff, that's all disappeared. So all you're left with now is just the iron components of the hull. But all of the internal structure was made of iron. The hull plating was made of iron. So you've effectively got this sort of clipper-style ship, and it's intact, aside from the damage incurred from the fire.
Dr. James Hunter is with us. Now, James, one of the interesting things that I've recently learned is that, as you say, it was quite common for people just to, when they don't want a boat anymore, it's too expensive, or perhaps times are really tough, you just go, I'll just abandon it.
Yeah. That's right. Having said that, it is important to realize that there were designated abandonment areas where you are supposed to put your ship. Supposed to. I say that because in many cases, it costs money. If you were going to discard your vessel in an abandonment area or what was known as a ship's graveyard, you generally had to pay for it. It wasn't something that you were going to be able to do for free. Because of this, what you often find is that people would find out-of-the-way places. And they would park their ships and kind of scurry off into the dead of night, you know, and so no one could trace it back to them.
Right. And they'd sink them, would they?
Yeah.
Just pop a little hole in before they ran off?
That's right. There were many different ways of doing it. This is an area of maritime archaeology that probably in the last 10 years or so has really sort of started to gain momentum. Because these sorts of things, it's a common thing. You know, abandonment areas, a lot of times these ship's graveyards, you can see them. You know, these collection of old hulls, you know, and they're just there. And it's a classic case of it's right in front of your face and you just don't seem to notice it. And for many, many years, nobody looked at these things. And a guy named Nathan Richards, who was a graduate of Flinders University in Adelaide, he really started looking at this and looking at all of the different things that were involved in the abandonment or discard of ships. And so you find that some of the ship's graveyards are in shallow water. They run them up on the beach and leave them. Some of them, they scuttled them out at sea in deep water. The whole idea, though, was to ensure that they were out of the way and they wouldn't become a hazard to navigation. And because of that, what you find is that many of these ships have things done to them. They have big holes punched in them to keep them from moving. Some of them actually have piles driven through them, you know. Just to anchor them in place.
Wow.
To reduce the risk of them floating free and becoming a hazard to navigation.
Right. So you've got to sink them properly.
That's right.
Basically. Yep. Right. So there are a few of these areas around Australia that you're aware of. Can you just tell us where some of the ship's graveyards are?
Yeah. One of the ones I'm most familiar with is at Port Adelaide. I'm a Flinders grad myself. I got my doctorate there. So up at Port Adelaide, there's a ship's graveyard called the Garden Island Ship's Graveyard. It's a really cool place to go because you can drive there. You got to kind of bush bash through some mangrove to get to the actual hulls themselves. But there's a whole line of ships parked there. And most of them date to the late 19th, early 20th century. But there's a combination of iron-hulled ships, wooden-hulled ships. They're all in very various stages of preservation. But it's a fascinating thing to see. And in some ways, they're really weird looking. Some of these ships that were composite built, so they had iron internal structure, but they had timber planking. The planking's gone because it's timber. And so what you end up with are these weird skeletons, you know, these big rib cages almost coming out of the water. And they're really compelling. They're quite amazing to see and very photogenic as well.
All right. And there's one outside Port Phillip Bay.
That's right. That's a different one. So the one at Garden Island, they ran them ashore. Primarily shallow area, muddy bottom, brought them in, knocked holes in them or whatever and left them. The one out off of Port Phillip Bay is called the Barwon Head Ship's Graveyard, and that one's different. That one, they scuttled them. So they towed them out into fairly deep water, pulled the plug, opened the sea valves, and whoop, down they went. And that covers several square kilometers where you've just got ships littering the bottom that were put there on purpose.
just astounding. So what would happen today if you wanted to get rid of a ship?
You do still see it happen. A lot of times nowadays, you're finding that ships are being sunk intentionally as artificial reefs.
Right.
As a way for diver tourism, to encourage marine ecosystem, that sort of thing. Very rarely do you see ships get sunk intentionally without a lot being done first. There are a lot of environmental concerns, you know, stripping the fuel and the oil out of them, getting the electrical wiring out of them, if they're asbestos, anything that's a contaminant that could affect the marine ecosystem, you generally try to get rid of that. That said, and I know this because I've seen this in my line of work, when I was in Florida, we were looking for shipwrecks, and we would check out anomalies. We'd find sonar anomalies or magnetic anomalies, and we'd get in the water and check them out. And on more than a few occasions, I ran across boats that had been sunk. I ran across a Volkswagen van sitting on the bottom of the ocean, which is a very random thing to see.
How far out?
Oh, this was in Pensacola Bay in Florida, and probably, I don't know, maybe, you know, 500 meters to a K off Santa Rosa Island. And the thing is, they were sunk to encourage fish
right.
to congregate. Okay. And they were sunk as either fishing or spearfishing, you know, areas, but they were done on the sly because, you know, you look at these things and go, yeah, that's a potential contaminant. That's a potential contaminant. And it was obviously been done in secret.
But if you had, say, James, like a giant cruise ship today that came to the end of its life, what would happen to that?
I think the greater likelihood nowadays is they'd probably get broken up and get scrapped. And you saw that sort of thing happen historically as well. And in fact, kind of an interesting side note about the Garden Island graveyard in Port Adelaide is that during the Depression, these areas became congregations for people to come and literally start dismantling these ships because they're, you know, people were poor. The Depression was in full swing. So people were taking the timber off of them to use as firewood in many cases or building material. And there were even instances of people living on them because they had nowhere else to go. So you had
parts that weren't fully submerged then.
Oh yeah. And there were parts of these hulls that were up out of the water, even at high tide. And you had instances where these tent cities were almost sort of developing in these graveyards because these people had nowhere to go. They couldn't afford to pay rent or buy a house, so they went somewhere. And the ship's graveyard was a good spot. It was free. It was kind of out of the way. Nobody was going to bother you. You had a source of timber nearby, you know, if you needed firewood or whatever. And that happened. And it happened all over the world.
James Hunter, fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for coming in to tell us about the Itata and other ships' graveyards.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me in.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.